For WKU Public Radio and NPR One, I'm Lamont Jack Pearly, and this is the African American Folklorist. When it comes to African American folklore, history, and traditions expressed through music, blues should be at the top of the list. I recently attended the W.C. Handy Blues and Barbecue Festival in Henderson, Kentucky, and sat down with a few artists, the co-chair, and music director. On this first installment of the festival interviews, I speak with blues legend Joe Lewis Walker.
I tell everybody that I talk to, I'm a musician and artist, sing a little bit, produce, perform. When I picked up a guitar, I did not say I was going to be a blues artist or a rock artist or this artist, and most musicians I know don't. We just, the idiom finds us. Just so happens that my daddy comes from Cleveland, Mississippi. In the late 30s to California, Camp Madera, Fresno. My mama coming from Little Rock, and all of their mothers, the fathers, they all left the South. I don't know if you've ever seen a program called the Beverly Hillbillies. They literally left, or the Grapes of Wrath. They literally left, with a pallet on the floor with 9, 10 people, 2 vehicles. So I was the youngest of the litter. And to make a long story short, my mother was, their Michael Jackson was B.B. King. My father, he just happened to live in the area down in the Delta where a lot of those guys who became famous, they were just brothers out there working in the fields and playing on juke joints. So some of them he knew, some of them he didn't. So he played his music for me when I was young. And my older brothers and sisters, they liked, at the time, 56, 57, 58, I was 8 years old. They liked all the music that was being new then. Chuck Berry, Elvis Presley, Fats Domino, Jerry Lee Lewis, all is here. And I got trickle down from all my older brothers and sisters. But what really got me into was my father, because he was really smart. He would play the blues for me, and then if I was a good boy, he'd play it. If I was bad, he wouldn't play the records. And he'd sit the record player right there. And he's stomping his feet, my uncles come over, and I don't want this. I want part of it. Then one of my father's friends played the guitar. And so I went over to his house, and the old men's was playing, 3 of them. The way Muddy and them used to play, the pants leg rolled up, 3 of them playing guitar, one playing the low end, one playing the high end, one playing the melody, and one playing juke, we called it. And when I seen that, I was hooked. And so they let me mess around a little bit, but they didn't want to bother with me. So my mother made a deal with me that if I went to a teacher and learned some notes, gave up my Saturdays, instead of going out with all the fellas playing baseball and football and this and that, I had to sacrifice. And so when I got 12 years old, she bought me a guitar. And that was the deal. Before that, I was just borrowing, And then we was living in projects, and then the project I lived in, we moved in, project about 7 blocks from all 4 of my cousins had a band. And I was like, God answered my prayer. All I had to do was go up there. And I learned, but they didn't let me play with them for a year. I had to carry the equipment. That's cold-blooded. They looked at me. But I got them, because when my mother sent me to the teacher, this lady, she wouldn't let me play the electric guitar, always the acoustic. But she would leave the room at the end and say, I'm gonna go to the store, you don't mess with anything, Joe Lewis. Minute I heard, boom, I'm on the guitar. You could hear me a mile away. And so she knew what she was doing. So to make a long story short, to be quite honest, my main influence is my mother and father. And I don't mean to be corny about it, but I mean, I heard so much B.B. King with my mother, I thought B.B. King was my father, And then when I started opening up for B.B. in the 80s, we did a show in San Francisco and I was living at home. I took my mother down there to see B.B. And she was just shaking. She couldn't even talk, this, that, and the other. Because I don't know if people have seen pictures of B.B. King when he was younger. He was a matinee idol, basically. Like all those guys, Charles Brown, Nat King Cole, they were good-looking young men. They were in their primes. But B.B. was the cream of the crop because he was a gospel singer in a blues singer's body and a great guitar improviser. Okay, and really smart. Really smart, you know, as far as how his music was presented. And my mother, I took her and I said, oh, Mom, it's B.B. And so we're taking the picture. And I told her, I said, B.B., you know, at one point she played your music so much, man, I thought you was my daddy. And I should have never said it because I spent so much time. He says, well, you know, Joe, I've been meaning to tell you something. I said, man, don't do this. So, you know, it was my parents really, and then my cousins were big influence on me. And then by me living in San Francisco, which was called the Fillmore, and then the Haight, it was all one big district, mostly African-American and Japanese and Jewish. And then around 65, a lot of young kids came from all over the country that wanted to have long hair, and women wanted to not have bras, gay people, human rights, civil rights, elder rights. And so my neighborhood changed. Our community playhouse, which was the Film Auditorium, changed from where I saw Little Richard get religion, where I saw the real Temptations, where I saw James Brown before he got a brand new bag, all black audience just like Harlem, to hippies. And all of us mixed together, which it took a while for everybody to, you know, sort of get along together. Because, you know, I mean, this is our hood, you know, and people just moved in. But then the people that moved in were cool.
So it wasn't necessarily like gentrification.
No, it was not gentrification.
Okay.
It's gentrification now. Right. I couldn't pay to live in my city. My daughter lives there, my grandsons, and she had a loft. You couldn't swing a mouse cost $1,000. You know, it was like, it's more than New York to live in San Francisco.
Yeah.
But anyway, it took some evening out, and the music was sort of finding, doing the same thing. You know, so you would have guys like B.B. King, who played the Film Auditorium when Charles Sullivan owned it, when it was black run. Mm. And then when Bill Graham had it, B.B. King couldn't play the Film Auditorium. Mm. Or he didn't play the Film Auditorium. And it wasn't because he was black, it wasn't because anything other than Bill Graham, for some reason, I don't know the particulars, but there were certain artists that he sort of gravitated toward. You could see it, Albert King, James Cotton, Muddy Waters always played the film. The Howlin' Wolf, I was there with the Wolf. Mm. All the English guys, the Yardbirds, Led Zeppelin, they all played the film out of them. And then all the guys that sort of came up learning how to play, who became icons, at Jerry and Bobby Weir Garcia and them, and then Yorma and all them, and John Cipollina and Quicksilver. And then you had the real, what I call, ground gestation for real change in music, okay. Which was, to me, a guy named Arthur Lee in Love. It was a group called Love. Because the guy that was a lot like Arthur Lee and wasn't as famous as Love was his acolyte, a guy named Jimi Hendrix. So when Jimmy came and played the Film Auditorium, it was crazy because you had this and you had people from our neighborhood who became famous, Freddie Stewart, Rosie Stewart, and his brother, older brother, Sly Stone, which a lot of people don't know was one of the first interracial soul bands.
Right.
You know, really. So you have all this jumping off. And then right across the bridge in Oakland, you got East Bay Grease. You know, you got a Tau Power. You got all them. Go make a left, you got straight up soul. You got guys starting like Michael Cooper and them Come Function. You got Frankie Beverly and them Back and Forth. You got all that. You got the Whispers. You got the Twink. So in the Bay Area, at the same time, you had all that. And then you had all the jazz cats coming. Like hell, I opened the show for Thelonious Monk.
Wow.
Okay? To show you how much everything was all mixed up. And I wasn't but 17, maybe 18. No, it was at the Fillmore West, not to be confused with the other Fillmore. There were two different places. So it was, I consider myself fortunate because my dad was born in Mississippi. The reason everybody left Mississippi because it was not conducive to us getting ahead. Just to be quite honest, it was dangerous to your life. My father was a big man. He was big as George Floyd. You see what I mean?
Yes,
so he could not, and he and his personality wasn't like that.
Right.
So he did as much as he could down south. So when he left, he literally left there like Tom Joad from Grapes of Wrath. He had to leave. There was no if, and, but about it. You know, if he didn't leave, and one thing he didn't want the same thing for his younger son. You know, he didn't want them, my brothers, my sister, he just didn't want that. There was no way to get ahead. And as we can see now, you know, it's still the same situation. You know, yeah. So if my dad would have stayed there, he would have gotten nowhere. You know, I wouldn't be sitting here with you. So it was a reason for everything. And so that's what music got me out of that. My father never lived long enough to see me become well known. My mom did, and everybody else. It's weird, my father's mother got the chance, you know, my grandmother lived to be 100. My mother's mother lived to be 100 also.
Wow.
My father's mother, 101. So they got to see, you know, but then I played in church for 10 years. I quit playing blues, 75 to 85, playing nothing in the church.
Really?
Yeah, I went back.
Do you mind sharing why you made that specific choice?
Well, a lot of my friends in secular music were dying, you know? I mean, I was never on a big scale as big stars like Jimmy and them and that. But if I was, I'd have been there with them, you know? But I wasn't on that scale, but I knew them. I was in parties with them, jam sessions, da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, nobody was really that huge. Nobody knew how big the business was. Mm. If they'd have known how big the business was, they'd have got less musicians and more lawyers, 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 lawyers. Mm. That's what they should have did. They didn't know anything about copyrights. Guys didn't know anything about mechanical likenesses, you know, being paid for your, didn't know any of that.
Wow.
You know, none of it. You know, and everybody, I mean, from the Beatles to everybody, got ripped off. That's just being honest.
So ultimately what you're saying is the rip-offs wasn't synonymous or only specific to the black musicians, even the black musicians that got ripped off by the Beatles.
Definitely not by the Beatles. The Beatles are everything that's right in music. All you got to go do is see a movie called 8 Days a Week. Go see that movie. In that movie, they come to the Beatles and they say, well, it's a segregated audience. Beatles says, we ain't playing. And then they desegregated every place they played after that. And in fact, right now, if you want to do something that you could, Paul McCartney wrote a song called Blackbirds. It's about the sisters, Little Rock Nine. 3 years ago, he took a picture with them. They're older now. So all the English guys, they never came over to be in competition with Americans. Every English guy I know, and I played with a lot of them, they tell me, man, we just couldn't believe how tight the United States was when we got here. We just thought since the music was all like this, we thought the people were all like this. We were surprised, you know, the Stones, when we went to Arkansas and they started spitting on us and calling us in this and in that. You know, today. So, no, all the English guys, they paid royalties. The Rolling Stones never did a show without opening at Ike Tina Turner Jr., Wales, Buddy Guy, Bo Diddley, you name it. The Beatles, the Ronettes, everybody. I mean, it's strange. Most of the musicians got along. Very few musicians wouldn't be around another musician because of the color of his skin. But you had people who were, by their upbringing, because, you know, just like I think you can be passed down, you can be bequeathed by your family, you can be taught not to put your hand in the fire, you can also be taught to hate people. And so, when that happens, you have to unlearn that. And that's the hard thing to do. We're going through that now in this country.
Absolutely.
You know, so, but I can say my experience with all the English guys that I know, you know, from Mick, I've done a couple of shows with Paul McCartney, private parties, to Keith. All those people have bent over backwards, you know, a lot. And they did a lot of songs by blues guys and got them money. Mm, I'll give you one example. Okay. I'll give you one example and I'll leave it at this. one of Rolling Stones, a good friend of mine, most of them, but Ronnie Woods, I've known him 33 years, more than that. I gave him a call and said, you know, Ronnie, a friend of mine is in Chicago. They called me and they want to come to the Stone show. I said, Lil Walter's daughter wants to come and say thank you. You know why? They had just let out a record, the Rolling Stone, called Blue and Lonesome. Mm-hmm. They'd been out three or four Lil Walter songs. Mm-hmm. She paid her home off with the royalty check. The first royalty check. Not the second, third, fourth, fifth. The first one. And she wanted to come and say thank you. Now put that in your pipe and smoke it.
Well, no, because I'm really happy.
Think about it.
I'm really, really, really happy that you told our story, because I know in one of the issues that a lot of the blues people were having, particularly, not even just the fact that they did the album, but that they won Blues Album of the Year in the Grammys. But I guess what you're saying is deeper than just that. It's the fact that those songs, the royalties to those songs, unlike other people, the royalties were going back to the family of these men and women that died penniless.
Going back to the families. Hubert Sumlin, good friend of mine, played with Howlin' Wolf.
I know who Hubert is.
Who do you think played for his funeral? Keith and Mick.
Okay.
They didn't want it to be known. Mick probably gonna get mad at me for saying it. Keith won't. But they paid for his funeral.
Okay.
And nobody asked them to. Okay? But here's the thing, I think where me and you were connecting is that was that generation of musicians. Mm. The generation that's come up now, it's a little different. I think the reason that those guys were appreciative and showed it with in their actions, because they weren't competing. Like the dude asked, I think it was Matt Murphy asked Keith, when the Stones first came to Chicago, what y'all want to play like me for? He gave him the perfect answer. He said, I can never play like you. He said, but what moves you, move me. Same thing. Say, I'm gonna play it my way. You're my boy. Muddy Love Stone. Wolf, him and Bill Wyman like father and son. Go fishing. The English guys were smart. They came over and paid homage, and they all got mentors. And the mentors that they learned from.
Right.
And what was a moment in history, and one of the first things that will happen, which I'm proud of Mick and Keith from doing it. I think it was 1965, they had a record called Satisfaction. Worldwide hit. The next album they had, next record they had, they recorded Little Red Rooster. The record company said, you ain't putting that music out.
And words.
Keith said, well, y'all ain't getting no more satisfactions.
Mm.
But here's the thing. They had a show called Shindig. Big show, all teenagers watch it, 1955. The Rolling Stones had the number one hit with Lil Red Rooster.
Really?
Would you come on, Stones, please do it? Yeah, we'll come on and do it. National TV, worldwide. If you let Howlin' Wolf come on with us. The first time in American history where you had a black blues man playing at white kids in front of an audience of millions.
Yeah.
You know what broke the Beatles on TV was Ed Sullivan.
Yeah.
Okay? Shindig was like Ed Sullivan. The next day, we're selling hundreds of thousands of records.
That's right.
So without that connection, and they didn't want nothing for it, they were trying to repay a debt. Okay? But I think what you're saying, and I sort of agree with you, is that for me, it's been my experience that America likes its reflection in a mirror. So, of course, Elvis Presley's record's gonna sell more than Big Mama Thornton's Hound Dog.
Right.
Because America likes its reflection in the mirror. Of course, Janis Joplin's gonna sell more Ball and Chain than Big Mama Thornton. Of course, Elvis is gonna sell more than That's All Right than Arthur Big Boy Crudup. And you know what? On all those people, for them to do that, they had to give Elvis's management 50% of the publishing, okay? So it was that sort of pay-in. But the English guys didn't want that, you know? And so there's a big difference. And just to be quite honest about it, the English guys were never in competition with the heroes.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to tune in to the second installment of my interview with Mr. Walker for WKU Public Radio and NPR One. I'm Lamont Jack Perley.